VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we reflect on the return of the EFL Cup with some cracking games in the fourth round, including Manchester City and Liverpool, who once again rekindled that massive rivalry. We'll talk about what that means in domestic football and, of course, what domestic football means to us. We'll also talk about Arsenal's chances of winning the Premier League and who might get relegated from the top flight. We will choose our alternative player of the year for 2022 and reflect on a magic year for women's football as well. This is The Game. Hello and welcome back to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wisencroft, joining you from Manchester, where I've been a couple of nights watching the EFL Cup fourth round action, including a great game between Manchester City and Liverpool last night. We will discuss that alongside much more with Molly Hudson, Tom Clark and Tom Allnut. How are you all?
Very well, Hugh. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to see my colleagues. I'm delighted to see Tom's got his Christmas jumper on, looking very festive, looking very excited. Hugh, you were telling us about your little gifts that you'd got from various clubs for the festive season.
I have on the table with me a bottle of white wine. It is from Manchester United, and they've also given the journalist that went to the game this week some vintage red wine from 2019. So I'll be taking that back. I don't know if it's some sort of bribe for me to be nicer about the club or what, but yes. See, there you go, sound effects. Manchester City last night gave us a coffee cup, a portable coffee cup, which
You probably won't be using. Come on, be honest.
They've basically put a Manchester City crest on it.
So that's a definite no then. I just wanted to out you on the podcast so that all your family members who listen to the show will know in a few days' time when you're dishing out a bottle of red wine and a Manchester City coffee cup that you actually got these for free.
The wine I'll brag about and pretend it was some sort of work perk. But, you know, that's going to be a stocking filler for someone else, that mug from Manchester City, to be perfectly honest. Thank you very much, City. But I just thought the oil money would have got me something a little bit nicer. That's all I'm saying.
That's fair. And just before we came on the show, Tom was confessing to not having had a gift, but to have maybe pinched one. Tom, that's right, isn't it?
I think we agreed this wouldn't be publicly aired, Tom, but... you know, if you're going to betray the agreements pre-podcast, that's fine. It was a few years ago now. So I think, you know, different regime, but there was a very classy looking bauble on the Tottenham training ground Christmas tree 1 year. And it felt like it was kind of post hours. I'd been there quite a long time. So I thought, you know, if they're not going to give me a gift, maybe I'll just take one with me. I think that's fair, no? Fair?
Anything that comes from a Premier League football club with the money that they've got, it's fair game. In my opinion. All right, we've outed you on the first. This is what this podcast is all about. Do you know what I mean? Full-on admissions here. That's what I like to hear. anyway, let's talk about the football, shall we? I think we're in a festive mood. Let's begin with that. But we're also quite happy about what's coming in terms of the festive football calendar, because in the Carabao Cup fourth round this week, in my opinion, we were reminded, and I know a lot of you have been watching EFL football in the last few weeks, since the return of the leagues beneath the Premier League. But we got to see, you know, firstly, in my opinion, the game between Manchester City and Liverpool at the Etihad, a higher quality football match than anything that we saw at the World Cup, in my humble opinion. No, I'm not saying it was more exciting than the World Cup final. Clearly it wasn't, but it was up there. But the fact is, I just think the teams are clearly well coached, well drilled, And it reminded us that with what we're going to see in the Premier League and what's to come for the second half of the season in the Champions League, I was right. I'll say it again. The World Cup is not the elite level of football, even though it's great to watch and we all love it, okay? But the good thing was, I think in particular the game, like I say, at the Etihad Stadium, we saw that the some of the elements that were missing from the World Cup, the atmosphere was absolutely incredible. Yes, we got it in about 8, 9, 10 matches at the World Cup. But, you know, maybe we are going to get it on a more regular basis in domestic football. Just like the World Cup, we saw Charlton beat Brighton on penalties, a giant killing, if you like, for the League One side. Fantastic for them. They face Manchester United at Old Trafford in the next round as their reward. But yeah, it had those elements that I think we might get over the coming weeks in terms of the FA Cup third round. We know what that means in terms of a special date in the football calendar. Even the Women's Champions League this week, goals galore. Big games, tough games, and I just think it whet the appetite for the second half of the season in so many different aspects. You know, like I say, the Etihad atmosphere was fantastic. There's bad blood, by the way. I've got to say this. It was weird because I was, as a Manchester United fan, sandwiched between my ops in the shape of Liverpool and Manchester City. But yeah, they have forged, I think, quite a strong rivalry and a relationship which isn't going anywhere, even if you feel like Liverpool maybe for the coming years 5-10% off where Manchester City are. I don't think this rivalry, what they've built up over the last 4 or 5 years, is going to go anywhere. And I think it's one that we just have to keep an eye on in terms of, you know, Premier League years, in terms of looking back at the greatest rivalries in the history of Premier League football. This could enter that realm. Tom Allnutt, talk to me, could it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I always think the Liverpool-Man City rivalry has just lacked a little bit of bite. I know everyone kind of loves the whole, you know, Guardiola-Klopp respect, admiration. You know, they always say that the other one is the best manager in the world, yada, yada, yada. I think, you know, which is all well and good, but it doesn't necessarily make for a, you know, grisly, exciting rivalry in the mold of the kind of Wenger Ferguson years, I guess, which has always been what this rivalry sort of lacked, is managers that kind of want to have a go at each other. But I think equally, we're kind of seeing more and more that these two teams in themselves have the players, have the quality to kind of match each other. And that is almost carrying the rivalry through. And obviously we've seen recently with this, with the fans as well, that's now adding a kind of an added element to it. So yes, I guess it depends a little bit, you know, to be honest, on how Liverpool do in the next few months. At the moment, there's not much of a rivalry in terms of the Premier League table. But with the news that, you know, Guardiola's staying on, you know, if we assume Klopp is also going to stay on, then I think there's a few years left to run yet, for sure.
I think Tom makes an excellent point about the managers. I would say, speaking as someone from Manchester and who's recording live from Manchester, I got off the train last night to see lots of merry Manchester City fans coming back from the game. I would say from a fan point of view, that rivalry has been there for a long time, just purely because if you're from Liverpool, you don't like people from Manchester. And if you're from Manchester, you don't like people from Liverpool. That's just how it's meant to be. So I think when you have two football teams who embody an elite level, it used to be United v Liverpool, but now City have very much taken on that mantle. I would say City fans have not liked Liverpool for a long time, and Liverpool, as much as they still have that rivalry with United, of course, have just transferred some of that angst towards Manchester City. So from a fan point of view, I'd say it's always been there. I think Tom's right that what it's lacking is that kind of managerial spice, but I'm not sure we'll ever get that from Pep and Klopp. But it's interesting, some of the points you make, Hugh, about the football, because whilst I agree with you that it was really interesting last night to be in the office before I got my train back, and there was a kind of a reluctant, almost excitement amongst everyone to be like, you know, I think we were all supposed to be, oh, we're not quite ready for football yet. Oh, it's so quick. God, this calendar's a bit mad. All these things that we know we're supposed to say. But ultimately, football, you know, domestic football at this time of the year, whether it's Premier League, whether it's cup competitions, whether it's the Football League, yeah, we do love it, really. We really do. And I think this game had all those ingredients you talk about, Hugh, but I wonder whether part of it was that essentially with this competition for both of these clubs and with the kind of teams that they put out, a mix of superstars and some youngsters, it allowed it to have a bit of a kind of almost like a second Community Shield type vibe where you could go for it a bit and you could play free-flowing football, which is why we had two goals in the first 15 minutes, and you had end-to-end stuff and you had some quite frankly, mad defending at times, because it you know, it wasn't a Premier League game straight off the bat. It was an EFL Cup game, and both managers would have had an out if they had lost 3-0, say, I think. So, and they both knew that, and it allowed that kind of a game to develop, which, when you get it between these two teams, is always great, great fun.
I think a lot of football fans thought there's going to be a lull after the World Cup. We're not going to see the same level of intensity for a while. The teams are going to build their way back into it. The players are going to build their way back into it. And there was absolutely none of that. It was like the caged beast. I mean, it wasn't, you know, you felt like it was going to be, I think that the billing had been, it's almost like they're coming off the back of pre-season. But it has not been like that. The intensity of the Manchester City game, again, it was just like, oh, they've been released. You know, it's all this pent-up frustration of not being able to play games. The likes of Erling Haaland, you know, back on the score sheet straight away, and you thought, oh, yeah, you know, we're back. We're absolutely back to what we missed, basically, at the World Cup. And, you know, I think we're fortunate. I think that's, for me, one of the big takeaways with our domestic football, with the quality of players that we see, that, you know, you can pick up with a League Cup and feel like you're watching a better game than you watched in the quarterfinal of the World Cup, for example. Molly, what are your thoughts?
I think you mentioned there maybe some people were worried about a bit of a lull after the World Cup. And I think for me, I don't think now is when we'll see that lull. I think it could be like towards the end of the season when everyone is properly knackered because they haven't had that break that they might have had, or they've like had extra travel or whatever. So I think now, in a way, it might almost work the other way, that they've like quite a lot of the players have had extra games, but then you're mixing that with people like Haaland who have had like a mini break and are going to come back even more sort of refreshed, which I'm sure is absolutely fantastic news for everyone that isn't Man City. So I think, yeah, I don't think we'll actually see that now. I think we might see it in a few months, and then people will start saying, oh, everyone's tired, it's injuries, it's like player load, all that sort of stuff. But I think in terms of Pep and Klopp, I think there is probably a bit more needle than there used to be as well in that rivalry. And I think it's just because like Klopp clearly doesn't like losing. And increasingly it's City that they lose to. And I think that is annoying him. And I think you see that. But I think it's just symptomatic of kind of those two teams that have been at the top, isn't it? Like you think of the great rivalries, they're always greater when the two teams are actually fighting for something. Whereas I think if you look at, say, Man United recently, sorry, Hugh, but some of their rivalries have maybe dimmed a little bit because they haven't been, like, they've still meant something as a derby, but they haven't meant something in the wider...
You can say they've been rubbish. You can say they've been rubbish. It's okay. Yeah. I won't hammer you. They've not been good enough. Yeah, they've not been good enough.
So it sort of ruins the rivalry a bit, doesn't it? Because you don't have that same feeling going into the game. Whereas I think for City and Liverpool recently, it's been like, I mean, maybe now it's like City have kind of overtaken everyone. But it did always feel like City were the team that could kind of get under the skin of Pep's team. So I think that's sort of maybe why that rivalry has become something that as well the neutrals like love, not just, you know, City and Liverpool fans. I think it's always a great game to watch, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a great game to watch last night. Tom, oh no, we just need to quickly reflect on the game. I had a feeling that this week, like I say, that the players would feel a little bit unshackled. I definitely think a lack of VAR. I know I hate to bring up those three letters.
Not again. Don't do it. It's Christmas. We're having a nice time. Don't do it.
It just made for a freedom of the players and the fans. They are, you know, the idea that when the ball hit the back of the net and the ref blew the whistle, that was it. You could celebrate. You know, I do think that people kind of revel in that. It feels like football again, you know, and I just think that helped make for not just at the Etihad a great round of the EFL Cup, because players weren't just like released from the fact that they hadn't played for a while. They were like, oh, we can just go for it. And that's why I think defending was, a lot of the games were end to end. The defending wasn't great because players were just like, it's a hit out. We're going to have fun. We're going to enjoy ourselves. It's been a while since we played. We're actually quite fit at this part of the season. So let's just go for it. And I just think they were fun games. I honestly really can't tell you how much I enjoyed them. Even the game at Old Trafford, even though Burnley should have scored at least once, didn't, but they made for a great tie against Manchester United. Yeah, I just think maybe if the players take this kind of freedom and this sense that they are, you know, they're back, if you like, into the Premier League, into the Championship and League One and League Two, it's going to be a great Christmas period.
Yeah, I think it feels a little bit like the start of the season. It's that kind of feeling you have in August, and it's a bit weird because it's freezing cold and Christmas, but it's a little bit like the restart. You're sort of having to remember what all the teams were doing a month ago, which is a bit like the start of the season. It's like, you know, new players sort of coming in. Can my team kind of completely reverse the form that they came into, you know, in November? Okay, there aren't new signings, but there are going to be soon in January. So there's this kind of whole new sort of excitement, enthusiasm feeling for a second half of the season, which actually, I mean, you know, we're sort of assuming it's a half-half, but it's actually not. We're only about a third of the way through, given it's only 14 games. So I agree. I think there is a real sense of excitement going into this kind of second half of this second period of the season. And I do think a lot of the players, I've been kind of looking into this because we're doing a piece on it for this weekend about kind of players coming back and resetting after the World Cup. And a few people have kind of mentioned that actually maybe, I mean, it remains to be seen, but maybe this idea of sort of fatigue and mental fatigue and everything is actually quite overblown. In many cases, the vast majority of players who went to the World Cup, you know, had a fairly middling tournament. You know, there are obviously the standout cases of people who sort of had incredible success or incredible disappointment, yes, and they have things to overcome. But for the vast majority of players, they played, did fairly well, coming back after a four-week tournament in a very nice, warm environment where everything has been very straightforward, no travelling, no kind of flying around Europe, you know, to European games, not even sort of, you know, getting on long trips around this country. You know, everything was very much easy and convenient for the players out there. And quite a few players obviously maybe didn't play as much as they would hope. They might have played, you know, 150 minutes or something across 4 weeks, which, you know, for a footballer is extremely light work. So there are a lot of players, what I'm saying is, coming back to the Premier League basically on the back of a kind of a competitive warm weather training camp, you know, and they're coming back into the Premier League now fairly fresh. Maybe there's a sort of sweet spot for certain players who sort of, you know, played three or four games and are coming back, you know, with a bit of competitive rhythm in their legs. But they've had a bit of a rest. I mean, for example, you look at someone like Harry Kane. I mean, last season, I looked during this period, he played 540 minutes for Tottenham. At the World Cup, he played 403 minutes. So he's played less football than he did last season. Kevin De Bruyne played also less football at the World Cup than he did during this period last season in the Premier League. So, you know, this idea that everyone's going to come back super fatigued, I take Molly's point that maybe later in the season, we might see a kind of delayed onset, but that is definitely true, particularly in April, May. Maybe the players will be like, blimey, you know, it feels like we've crammed a lot of narrative into this season. But I think in the next month or two, we might see a kind of a bit of an adrenaline push. And, you know, from players and from fans as well, who obviously are delighted to kind of have club football back again.
And I would count myself as one of those people. Boxing Day fixtures will be absolutely fantastic. We can maybe predict what will come a little bit later in terms of those games. But the second half of the season, I think that's where we should maybe aim our conversation next, rather than that specific date, particularly when it comes to the top flight. And yeah, we'll review some of our early predictions for 2022 in a moment. Maybe we should make some early predictions for what's to come between now and the end of the season. And I wanted to start with, I think it's probably the best game on Boxing Day for me, Arsenal's game against West Ham on Boxing Day. And Arsenal, top of the Premier League table. The question is, will they sustain what they've shown us in the first 14 games? That's it. Simple. Molly?
I have to say, as somebody who doesn't support any of these teams, so neutral in a sense, I am increasingly finding myself wanting somebody that isn't Man City to win the league. And especially last night, I was at the Women's Champions League at Stamford Bridge and saw like the goal update of Haaland, and I was like, oh, here we go again, he's back, which is fantastic if you're Man City, but it's like a bit of like cheat code, isn't it? So I'd love to see Arsenal go on and win it. I think I completely agree with what Tom A was saying, but I think Arsenal, probably the team that have struggled, are going to struggle the most because of the World Cup, because of, sorry, you might be able to hear my cat meowing in the background, because of Gabriel Jesus's injury. I think that's probably the worst thing that could possibly have happened to them. So I think in that sense, I think I actually did back them. Like, I know a lot of people were saying, oh, they'll fall away in the second half of the season. They've got no chance. It's Man City, it's Pep, it's Haaland, which I completely understand. But I genuinely think they was playing really good football. There was a great vibe around the club. They've been building something under Arteta. But I think now it's just whether they can do it without Jesus, I suppose. It's like the ultimate test. It's like, what's the thing that could have thrown them off track the most? And it is probably this injury with the kind of lack of number nines they've really got at the club after they let Aubameyang go, didn't really bring anyone in until Jesus. So this is me not answering your question at all. But I personally would like Arsenal to go and do it, just to liven it up again so that it's just not City again. So I'm going to say Arsenal can do it.
Even you seem convinced.
The World Cup might have ruined it. So for all of the talk of the World Cup not affecting the Premier League, it might have ruined it.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Mikel Arteta say that Arsenal want to go into the market off the back of the Jesus injury, because I think they gave Eddie Nketiah a £100,000 a week contract last summer. So it's kind of like, well, I mean, if you wanted him to be the backup, now's his moment. He's probably going to get a run of a few games before they can bring someone in. But also it's like, what level of quality, especially a centre forward, are you going to get in January, and how much money are you going to need to spend to bring in a decent one? So I think Nketiah maybe gets it from here on out. And I listen, I'm intrigued to see what Eddie can do, because he scored goals at the end of last season, important goals for Arsenal. Give the guy a chance. Let's see what he does. I'd kind of be maybe a little bit unhappy if I was Nketiah over those comments, but it's up to him to prove to his manager that he is going to be the main number nine.
I think you make a really good point, Hugh, about Nketiah. And I was thinking about him when I was reading Mikel Arteta's quotes about the transfer window and spending money, because it's fascinating with Arsenal, isn't it? They've almost gone too far ahead of the projected plan, almost. When we think about where they were this time last season, and we're going to play some of our predictions, which aren't going to fare well for me, I don't think. But I was praising Mikel Arteta and saying, you know, they're going to do it. They're going to get top four. And here they are, talking about a title challenge. And I know Arsenal fans are incredibly excited, but think about where the club has come over the years and that kind of slow transformation, giving Arteta time. If they then turn it into a tiny, tiny, short trajectory of the next 6 months, try and win the title, it could lead to some bad decisions, I think. And if they then take that into the transfer market and say, right, we need a striker essentially for 6 months, and we're going to spend money and maybe buy someone that doesn't fit the model, which we've worked so hard to build over the last couple of years, it could backfire on them. And that's where I think you're right, Hugh, giving the contract to Nketiah fitted with the model of what Arteta has built over the last few years. Young players, hungry players, players that fit his system. Give him a chance now. If that means, as Molly says, you're missing Jesus and ultimately maybe miss out on the chance of a proper challenge for the title, that might not be a terrible thing in the long run. Because if the alternative is going and spending a lot of money on a superstar striker, then I don't know whether that'll do you any good in the long run.
Yeah, I think Tom's point is a sensible one. I think it's probably the one that Arsenal will decide. But I can't help think that this is just a massive opportunity for Arsenal. You know, I think they've given themselves a window here that maybe there won't be many clubs who will have this opportunity maybe for a while. You know, we look at Man City, they very, very rarely give anyone a sniff in the Premier League title race. They've won the title, what is it, 5 out of the last 6 years? And the one time they didn't win it was to an exceptional Liverpool team. I think when you have a 5-point lead after 14 games, okay, it's still early days. But I just think Arsenal maybe have to roll the dice here. I mean, I know that's probably not the kind of, you know, Tom, you sound very much like a sporting director. I think that's exactly the right thing. I think that's exactly what you should do. Long-term planning, don't upset the apple cart, bring in the right kind of recruitment strategy, all this kind of thing. But ultimately now they have 6 months where they could win the title, and they start a sort of a mini season with a 5-point lead over Manchester City, who very, very rarely give anyone a chance these days. And I just think if they could be really bold in this January market, maybe make a couple of signings. You know, we see how much kind of, for example, Kulusevski and Benton could, you know, transform Tottenham last season. It can happen. The January market is very difficult, but it can happen that you can find one or two players if you're prepared to spend a bit of extra money. And if they did that and brought in a really good central midfielder, you know, and another striker, for example, then I think they could really go all the way. I think they have that momentum. They have a base. They have a really good spirit. There's huge belief and a real sense of unity at Arsenal behind the manager now. I would just like to see them kind of not be sensible in January and maybe sort of just go for it and try and do something special. But I suspect you're right. They will sort of stick to the plan.
One thing's for sure in terms of my New Year's resolutions is to make sure to get you on the podcast more, Tom. If you're going to call me a sporting director, that's definitely the nicest thing that's ever been said to me on this show. But you make a really interesting point, and I'd be fascinated to know what Arsenal fans listening to this are thinking, whether they agree with me, Mr. Pragmatism, or you, Mr. Romantic, go for it, we could win the title. Because I think they'll be really split. I would be willing to come into your camp if the money is spent on someone who fits the model. I don't mind them spending money, that, you know, as you say, you can spend money in January. But the point with your Bentancur and Kulusevski examples are that they fitted what Conte wanted going forward at Tottenham. And I just don't know whether there's a striker out there who can, because essentially what they'd be signing is a rival to Eddie Nketiah / backup to Gabriel Jesus long term. And you're then going to have to overspend on that. But also he's going to have to be good enough to replace Jesus in the long term. It's such a small, tiny like margins that you're looking for here. I just don't know whether that player exists. And I think what you then end up doing the other way is you're essentially looking to but find another Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang to buy back for 6 months. That's essentially what I think they're ending up looking for. And that could massively, I know you're saying upset the apple cart, but it's a delicately balanced apple cart at Arsenal. And it's been a very upset one over the last couple of years. He's finally got everything really sorted. So I just wonder whether he'd be able to find that that perfect signing.
Cristiano Ronaldo is still available for a short term contract. So you don't always have to go out and spend big. No, I'm joking. Of course, I'm joking. All I would say is I think there are some Arsenal fans who maybe see the bigger picture different to others. Some will feel that we're, you know, Arsenal are building towards being a side that can win the Premier League, and if it's not this year, then it can be the next year or the year after that, especially with a very young and talented side. I think there are some who sense the reality of what's going on in the Premier League right now, and you're not going to have many opportunities to win the Premier League, especially with the spending of the other clubs around them, which, for, you know, Manchester United spend more. They're not better, but they spend more. City obviously spend more. Newcastle United look like they're going to be big spenders. How are you going to win the Premier League when City, Liverpool, we know are a great side. Newcastle might be there within 3 years and suddenly your opportunity's passed, even if you are back to being a regular top four side. So there are some Arsenal fans who I think will be saying, look, we're not going to have many of these opportunities over the next 10 years. Let's go for it. Let's buy a player who's young, who's good. And if we spend, you know, a little bit extra money, maybe we've still got good resale value on that player. We'll either get the money back or the vast majority of it back. Might only cost us £5-10 million. And for a lot of Arsenal fans, excuse me, that will be worth it. But we'll see. I'm intrigued to see if Arsenal can keep it up, to be honest, because I think they have been the best team in the Premier League so far. I wanted to ask you about Newcastle, but I think we can come to that after Boxing Day, because I do definitely want to ask a similar question. I didn't know we were going to talk about Arsenal for so long, but about the bottom of the table. And I was going to ask specifically about Southampton under Nathan Jones and whether they can stay in the Premier League. But actually, you look at the bottom of the table, the bottom seven teams separated by 6 points from Bournemouth down in 14th, Leeds United, West Ham, Everton, Nottingham Forest, Southampton, and the bottom club is Wolves. Who now they've got Julian Lopetegui, you forget that they're actually bottom of the Premier League after 15 games. How do you see, and I'm not asking you to make a major prediction on who will finish in the bottom three, but do you see a team in there, Molly, who will rise from the ashes?
It's funny that you just said about sort of forgetting Wolves were down there. That's exactly what I did the other day. I was actually reading the report of their Carabao Cup game, possibly. Yeah, read that they were bottom of the league and actually had to like go back, check the Premier League table and see that they were indeed bottom of the league. So I had completely forgot, but I suppose that would be my prediction, that I don't think they'll go down. I think Southampton have kind of, they almost hung on to Ralph a little bit too long, I think. And now that's quite a difficult job, I think. So yeah, my sort of prediction that you can record and then play and age terribly is that Wolves will get out of there. I think they'll be fine. West Ham are struggling a little bit again, aren't they? Bit of a weird sort of club with the whole European football element thrown in there as well. But yeah, I think Wolves will be fine.
Come on, Molly, that's not much of a bold prediction, saying Wolves with all that superstar squad of European talent is going to get out of relegation. Don't be coming on the show and pretending you're bold making a prediction like that, honestly. I think it's interesting at the bottom because Wolves are not the only club who their fans and a lot in, you know, of us in the media would be sensing will have an upward trajectory. You talk about Southampton having changed manager, but I think teams like Leeds, I could see Leeds improving with the kind of young players that they've got, players like Tyler Adams who impressed at the World Cup. It feels like they're, while still potentially being a little haphazard at times, I wouldn't be surprised if they put a little run together at some point. As much as Molly's right that West Ham are struggling, I can't see them staying down there under David Moyes too long. So it's going to be interesting to see what the likes of Wolves and if Leeds and West Ham and some of those teams start to rise up the table, what that means for teams a bit higher up than you mentioned, Hugh. You know, Crystal Palace, yes, they've got 19 points already. But I know from some colleagues in the office that that means absolutely nothing to a Palace fan in terms of their survival at the end of the season. And you go up to even teams like Fulham and Brentford, who've had very solid starts to the season. Fulham particularly been impressive. But you just look at teams below them and wonder whether they'll be caught up and dragged back down into things. Aston Villa as well, with a new manager, as of course, you can sense that they'll become quite hard to beat under Unai Emery and become quite solid. So it's going to be interesting to see that shift between teams that maybe creep up. And we've done these before on the desk, those kind of fascinating graphs that track teams through the season and you move along in terms of the dates as the season progresses and the kind of the movements up and down the table. I wouldn't be surprised to see some of those teams around the kind of 9th to 14th range, Bournemouth, Leicester, Palace, Brentford and Fulham, maybe dragged back down by teams at the bottom creeping up.
You know what? You get the feeling looking at the Premier League that just about nobody is safe, because either it's a really tight league when you look at the records of teams. There's only a few clubs with a win rate that is above 50%, to be perfectly honest. Only the top five have won more than half of their games. And even when you look at Tottenham in fourth, Man United in fifth, Liverpool in sixth, they've all lost four games already in the Premier League, pretty much on track to lose double figures of games. And look, there was a bit of a feeling that teams were treading water a little bit in the opening part of the season. A lot of people with one eye on the World Cup, players too with one eye on the World Cup. When you look at the bottom part of the table, I only did the bottom seven teams because I thought, look, Leicester City 13th, Villa 12th, Palace 11th. Are they going to get dragged back into it? Brentford 10th. But Fulham in 9th, you almost think, oh, they're not that far. You know, they're 6 points above the relegation zone at this point in time. You know, just takes a bad run of, you know, five or six games and they'll be right back in it. So it's very difficult to call at the bottom of the table. And you wonder just who's going to go out in January and spend the money that maybe will see them survive in the Premier League. And that might be the difference.
I think that's an interesting point about January spending, particularly with some of those managerial changes that we've talked about. But you mentioned them there, Leicester City. I mean, do we think we'll be on this podcast this time next year and Brendan Rodgers will still be Leicester City manager? That would be extraordinary if he was. Imagine if he turned it around and got them up into the kind of top eight and was still Leicester City manager after all they've been through. We talked about them for the last year in terms of the narrative around their club being what they are, being fascinating. Does anyone else see Rodgers still being here in a year's time, Tom?
No, I think probably not. I mean, I think if they do well and they recover, not only would it have been a great job by Rodgers, to be honest, although recovering from a position, you know, that probably we wouldn't have expected Leicester to be in, right? It might suit Rodgers and the club to kind of have an amicable parting next summer. I think what's kind of interesting as well is that there have been so many managerial changes already and that the World Cup has obviously given us has given them a period of settling in that they might not otherwise normally have had. We know when managers come in mid-season, we always kind of see them as having to kind of hit the ground running, make do with what they have. Whereas this time, you know, coaches like Emery, for example, have had, you know, a really good month with the vast majority of their squad on the training ground, which, you know, for someone like Emery, who's very much a kind of details-minded coach, very much about kind of planning for opponents, huge amounts of video analysis, you know, this kind of thing wouldn't have been possible if there wasn't kind of a month-long break to go through all that. And so we might see, you know, some of these teams who have made managerial changes massively benefiting from that. Equally, I think, you know, if we're talking about Wolves, for example, bringing in a load of new signing in January, this is probably not the season when you want to be gelling, you know, five or six new players in the second half of the season, because there are going to be so many matches all the time that there isn't really going to be any time for people to meet each other and get used to each other. I think there are some interesting subplots. I mean, for example, Ivan Toney, you know, we're talking about Brentford flying high at the moment. But what happens if Toney gets a lengthy ban in what we think will probably be February, you know, when the verdict will come? You know, it could well be that Brentford have to play the last 3 or 4 months of the season without their star player and basically their main source of goals. And I think Jones at Southampton is a really interesting appointment. You know, everyone who knows Jones much better than I do, you know, talks of him as being an extremely intense coach, very focused, very good sort of motivator, but can maybe, you know, could go either way. You know, Southampton have a very young, malleable squad with some very talented young players. And it might be that they have the kind of makeup of their team that could suit a manager like Jones. He might be able to sort of get those players to rally around him very quickly. But if not, I think it could equally go south quite quickly as well. So I agree. I think it's close. There are some big teams like West Ham and Everton are right down there. I mean, blimey, Everton probably finished the pre-World Cup season, you know, worse than anyone, I felt. You know, those two defeats to Bournemouth, aggregate score 7-1, I think. You know, I think Lampard was pretty relieved to get that break. And he needs to start quickly, that's for sure.
Yeah, number of clubs in that position in the second half of the season. Thank you guys for coming with me on that journey as to what might happen. And up next on the Game Podcast, we're going to look back on some of our predictions for 2022. I wonder how wrong we were. So take everything we just said with a massive pinch of salt on the basis of what you're going to hear next. Stay with us. Right then, we made some predictions at the end of 2021, and we're going to take a look next at how they worked out. It was myself alongside Tom Clark and Jonathan Northcroft, and the first thing we predicted going out to Qatar was England's World Cup chances.
I think they might get to the final. I don't think they'll win it, but I think the ride might continue under Gareth.
I think they might not struggle. They'll probably do what old-fashioned England in quarterfinals, but as Johnny says, under Gareth Southgate, that would be seen as a failure. But yeah, something about, I don't know, the transition of the team will have those same Grealish Foden problems again, and it won't quite work. And so yeah, quarterfinals, I'm going to say.
The draw cannot be as nice for England as it has been in previous World Cups. So I think we're getting a tough group stage draw. That might affect things. We might get a tough second round as well. So I'm going to put the spanner in the works and say quarterfinals, but because we play very difficult teams and we'll still leave with some pride from Qatar in 2022.
I think we should bask in this while we can, Hugh, because I think it's downhill after here. But, you know, let's we now know why England did so badly, because they were jinxed by a Scotsman, obviously.
Yeah. Jonathan Northcroft getting things wrong. I like the fact that we were quite accurate in the detail that we went into, Tom. So, yeah, pat on the back for both of us in terms of our 2021 prediction for England's World Cup chances. You may be right. Might go downhill from here, because I don't remember seeing Scotland play any matches at all in Qatar, and hopefully none of us predicted that, did we? Well, here's one call we got wrong.
Of course they will. Yeah, Ukraine are there for the taking, and we always beat Wales in the playoffs. Easy one.
I think that says it all. You've got a Scot being confident. We've said it about Steve Clarke, what he's done to that squad. Yes, all the way.
I tend to agree. I think the playoff draw went very nicely for them. Yeah, immediately downhill. Very, very, very vertical in terms of our predictions there. No, look, we thought Scotland were going to do well. They let us down. You know, I'm not going to take that one on. Everything we said there was correct in terms of their chances. They had a great chance. They bottled it. That one's for you, Greg Robertson. Anyway, Johnny and Tom were also off the mark about two other teams at the World Cup.
Portugal will miss out. They've got some rather Manchester United-like problems, and I'll leave it there.
I can't see Italy missing out. I think a little bit of a blip, but they'll go back to all the Italian qualities, and that'll see them through, I think.
Devastated, Tom.
Yeah, never mind. I mean, I'm going to put that down to my bias towards all things Italy and my love of going on holiday there. So at least they'll let me back in the country with that kind of favouritism. But I would say Johnny, in his defence there, and he's getting an absolute kicking by not being on this show to defend himself. Love you, Johnny. Miss you. He wasn't all that wrong Portugal long term, was he? In terms of the things he said about them having some Manchester United-like qualities, they potentially showed through when it came to the tournament itself. He just maybe called it a little too early.
Right then, let's move on, because Erling Haaland's future was the big topic last Christmas, but who called it right?
I think he'll be playing in a wide position for Manchester City as Pep Guardiola signs him and then tries to make him unlearn being a number nine.
I would really like one of the English clubs to sign Robert Lewandowski so that we can see him play in the Premier League, and therefore Bayern Munich will do what Bayern Munich do and go and sign the best players from their rivals. So Erling Haaland will be there.
It's a tough one. I'm going to say Manchester City.
You picked the easy one, man. I'm not giving you that as a good prediction. Was
it the easy one at the time?
Yeah, come on. I went left field. I went Bayern Munich. I should be praised for being a bit different.
There are definitely two correct predictions so far. Two out of three. I mean, who produces this podcast?
This is how it works. We need to speak to producer John. I mean, it's almost like they work together and they know each other quite well. It's a bit of a fix, isn't it? It's disgraceful.
Such a shame.
I'm usually wrong about everything. If you go back and listen to the recaps of my predictions on literally every other podcast, this is the best one for me so far, I have to say. Got to say, just in Jonathan Northcroft's defence, because he'll be listening thinking, they've thrown me under a bus. He was being a little bit facetious. I don't think he thought Pep Guardiola was actually going to play Haaland out on the wing. But anyway, let's move on. Finally, we predicted who would be in charge at Manchester United come the end of 2022.
Well, I'm going to stick with Thomas Tuchel. Let's be a bit whimsical.
Part of me hopes that actually they keep pulling everything apart so much to the extent that it gets to the summer and actually they realise, let's just keep going down the road we're doing. And so Ralph Rangnick will still be manager for another season of rebuild. But if not, let's go my new favourite manager of the moment after he proved me right for defending him on Monday's show, Brendan Rodgers.
Okay. I'm going 6-year deal from Mauricio Pochettino. I think that's got Manchester United written all over it, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, dear.
Now I've got it right.
Oh, dear. That's pretty bad, isn't it? I mean, I'm laughing because I've very, very nicely managed to make it home for Christmas, and I'm currently sat in the same place in my parents' house where I was sat when I made that exact prediction last year. So I knew it was coming. And I mean, all I can say is Manchester United fans, thank God I was wrong, eh? Ralph Rangnick transition into a Brendan Rodgers takeover. Yeah, I'm not sure that would have gone as well as Erik ten Hag.
Yeah, I've still got question marks. We'll see. We'll see when it comes to Manchester United. We will make more very, I think, debatable, let's call it that. Let's be nice. Debatable predictions as we move into the new year. Plenty of festive podcasts to come for you. We'll predict what we think will happen in the next 12 months in a few weeks' time. But that was our look back on 2021. Well, I'm going to give us a solid 6 out of 10.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Gregor has dipped in to our next topic, which is an alternate player of the year, an alternative player of the year. So many of us have got involved, in fact, on the game podcast with this, and we might as well start with Gregor to see exactly what he's done. Has it been obvious? Has it been, you know, so clear in his mind that all of us are just going to skim beyond his alternative player of the year? Is he obvious? Is he captain obvious?
My alternative Premier League player of 2022 is Kieran Trippier. Whatever our views of the new regime at St James's Park these days, Newcastle United have been the team of 2022. They were 19th in the Premier League on December 31st, and they're now third in the Premier League. And whether we like it or not, that feat after two transfer windows and with this team is pretty extraordinary. And without doubt, in my eyes, the player who's had the biggest impact for Eddie Howe's side since he joined from Atletico Madrid in January is Kieran Trippier. He's created more chances than any of his teammates. He's scored some crucial free kicks, makes more successful crosses per game than any other player in the Premier League. He's second only really to James Ward-Prowse in terms of his set-piece accuracy. That's been a huge facet of Newcastle's play. And I just think that when he returned to the Premier League after 3 years in Spain, after winning La Liga, the whole narrative was about how much Trippier had improved defensively under Diego Simeone. And that's true. He's a big reason why Newcastle have conceded only 11 goals this season and have the joint best defence in the league. But he's arguably their most important creative player too. And I think he's been absolutely outstanding in 2022. So Kieran Trippier is my alternative player of the year.
What do you think, Tom? He's argued for genuinely not an alternative player of the year, but his player of the year. I mean, he is captain obvious.
Yeah, I mean, he started out thinking, it's quite left field. But then by the end of it, I've decided it's the most obvious choice you could have made. We'll stick with him as an alternative choice. I think once we all make our nominations and we hear from some other Friends of the Game podcast, I think Gregor will end up looking pretty obvious by the end of it.
Right, before we go to one of our other friends, let's discuss ours. Molly Hudson, I'll come to you. Who have you chosen as your alternative player of the year?
Because it was alternative, I was thinking about kind of like moments I've had this year that have been like, I think as journalists, occasionally you have those moments where you feel like a fan and like you're genuinely buzzing. And for me, in a very unexpected turn of events, it was the Arnold Clark Cup, which is the most unexciting, unglamorous thing ever, at Molyneux. And England were playing Germany and it was 1-1. And to win this inaugural like friendly tournament, to win this cup that nobody will remember ever again, was we needed to win the game. And Serena Wiegmann put Millie Bright, the centre-back, up top. And as someone who absolutely loves the idea of that, and I love the fact that Serena doesn't care about pretty football or whatever. If you need to win, she'll just stick a big man up top, essentially. And she did that, and Millie Bright scored the winner. And it was just the best thing ever. And then the even better part of this narrative was that she ended up winning. She'd already scored earlier in the tournament from like a set piece or something. And she ended up winning the Golden Boot, sharing it with Alexis Putellas, the Ballon d'Or winner. At the end of the game, when they did the trophies, Alexis was like, do you know what, Millie, you can have this one. Just gave her this Golden Boot for the Arnold Clark Cup. And aside from that being a fantastic moment, it also sort of foreshadowed what happened in the European Championships as well, because we were essentially in the exact same position against Spain in the quarterfinals. And again, Serena put Millie up top and she didn't score this time, but she kind of made a nuisance of herself and England did end up scoring. So I think of all of the England players that maybe you could have picked, I'm going for Millie Bright, the super sub. Well, super striker. She was still on the pitch. She just moved forward.
That's more like it. Molly puts Robertson right in his place with a proper alternative prediction. Superb.
Tom Molnar, do you want to go next?
Yeah, I'm going to go for Emiliano Martinez, because although he is the most hated man in football, I think, at the moment, I think we have to give credit to someone who makes the whole world feel sorry for Kylian Mbappe, who, let's not forget, you know, earns 200 million euros a year and had, you know, various heads of state phoning him to persuade him to stay at PSG in the summer. And the stars are very much aligned for, you know, Mbappe to win the World Cup for Qatar and for PSG, et cetera, et cetera. And I understand, you know, the whole Messi narrative, you know, very, very good for football, romantic, what a legacy, greatest player of all time, et cetera. Very nice, you know, very, very cozy for football. But, you know, football needs its villains, you know, and the World Cup wouldn't have been the same without Martinez. And ultimately, he was the one who denied France, you know, basically a back-to-back World Cup, which, you know, nobody wants. And most of all, you know, in his celebrations, yes, maybe he went a bit far, but equally, everyone now thinks that Mbappe is this sort of wrong victim of the World Cup final. And I think credit to him. I think credit to him for changing the narrative, in being an innovator when it comes to saving penalties and putting people off. I'm all for it. I'm all for the badness of Emiliano Martinez. He is therefore my alternative player of the year. I would like to put in a word as well for Miguel Almiron, given, you know, Jack Grealish saying that doing how Almiron is basically playing badly. And then Almiron went on to score about 16 goals in 10 games, which I thought was a pretty good transformation. So I give him a sort of a silver medal in my alternative player of the year, but Martinez is the standout champion.
Lovely shouts. Lovely shouts there. Yeah, good. Okay, all right, let's continue. I actually enjoyed that because I think, yeah, I'm not a fan of Martinez at the moment, but that does make him alternate. That makes him an alternative player of the year, despite his triumph and the Golden Glove celebration. Anyway, let's hear from James Restall next. He's given us his alternative player of the year.
My alternative player of 2022 is Oleg Sinchenko. The first half of 2022, he won the Premier League with Manchester City amid the backdrop of the horrendous war in Ukraine, which clearly deeply affected him and the other Ukrainian players in the Premier League. And nonetheless, he remained a seriously influential player for Manchester City during that period. He then moved to Arsenal in the summer, where he's had a massive impact and has been transformational in getting Arsenal to the top of the Premier League. So I think he's deserving of great praise for a truly remarkable 2022.
I like it. I like it a lot. Zinchenko's huge impact at Arsenal. But yeah, I think James is right to highlight all of the stuff that was going on in his home nation and what an emotional year it was. And he's come through it strongly in terms of his football. So yeah, he can be proud of everything he's done. Who knows? He might pick up another Premier League winners medal at the end of the season. That would be an incredible, incredible result for him. Okay, not long to go on these. Tom Roddy is next.
My alternate player of the year is Eric Dier, partly because of the recovery in his career over the last year, over 2022. It's easy to forget now that in 2021, Jose Mourinho was manager at Tottenham and Eric Dier's form really fell off a cliff. He was struggling at Tottenham massively, and the consequences of that was losing his place in the England squad and the dent that made in his confidence was significant. And I think even Antonio Conte may have touched on that when he first became the Tottenham head coach. And now we are heading into 2023, where Eric Dier is really a key member of that squad, of that team, and for Tottenham, and maybe and a totally underappreciated one, really, because it is quite natural that we look at Harry Kane, we look at Heung-Min Son, we look at Dejan Kulusevski, And even in defence, there is a natural tendency to look at Christian Romero because of his qualities. But Eric Dier has been a significant part of making this work for Antonio Conte, because he doesn't have the midfielder that he's had in the past, like Cesc Fabregas at Chelsea and Christian Eriksen at Inter Milan. So he's needed Eric Dier to both be the defensive rock, but also that quarterback, the guy who can spray the ball, play those long balls up down the channels, the fast wingers. Again, the kind of the consequences, the reward for this uptake in form was being part of the England squad. And I know, obviously, he didn't play a significant role in Qatar, but at one stage, probably before the tournament, you could say quite justifiably on form that maybe Harry Maguire shouldn't have been in the team and that Eric Dier should. I think Gareth Southgate made the right decision there, but it's kind of by the by. It's Eric Dier on form probably deserved to be starting in the England team at centre-back.
Okay, Eric Dier. Now, listen, I'm liking these. In terms of comeback stories, Eric Dier right up there. Tom Roddy is right. But I've gone for the ultimate comeback story so far this year in the shape of a man who I'm often negative about, Manchester United's Harry Maguire. Yes, Harry Maguire. I don't know how the meme goes, but something along those lines. The point is, he has been ridiculed. He has been ridiculed. And I will say this, the ridicule maybe was unfair to Harry Maguire. Maybe was unfair. It went a little bit too far. It crossed a number of lines because it wasn't just about his football, which was not good enough for most of the year. But the point is, when the whole country is screaming, he shouldn't be in the England squad, shouldn't be anywhere near the team. And I agreed with that. All of us agreed with that. If you thought he should start, Gareth Southgate, I'm talking to you, then you're an idiot. But ultimately, he has proved his manager right. He has proved all of his doubters wrong with his World Cup performances, which were once again exceptional. And who knows, maybe he has resurrected his Manchester United career. Maybe we will see a new and improved Harry Maguire. Maybe the time out of the team has actually helped him. But anyway, in terms of his performances in an England shirt, they cannot be questioned on the biggest stage with all, you know, everyone watching, your whole nation's hopes behind you. He excelled once again. And just for those few games that he played at the World Cup, he is my alternative player of the year, because with everything that was on his shoulders, he had every right to crumble. He had every right to lose his place, make the errors that we've seen before. And he went up against some of the best players in the world. And yeah, I think he performed admirably. That's the compliment that I'm giving you, Harry. You performed admirably. Thank you. I will try my best not to criticise you as much in 2023. That's a promise.
It's a Christmas miracle, everyone, on the Game Podcast. He wasn't crossed. You turned on Harry Maguire. Wonderful, wonderful to listen to you, Hugh. Give such a glowing tribute to the big man. And I've got to say, I've got to commend you. That's really right up there in terms of alternative shouts. Wonderful stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. Good luck, Harry, in 2023. Yeah, I've turned on Harry Maguire. You are right. And I wish him the best in 2023. Hopefully he'll bring home some big trophies for Manchester United. More likely he'll be sold. But anyway, Tom Clark, you are last. Who have you gone for?
Well, you've left me with a very, very difficult task after that excellent suggestion, but mine is arguably so alternative that some Premier League fans might not even heard of him. With some of those embarrassing predictions in mind earlier, I wanted to cheat a little bit and give an honourable mention to Andres Pereira at Fulham. I think in our pre-season preview show, I said that he wasn't a great signing and he wasn't going to do anything to keep them in the Premier League. After starting 2022 on loan again from Manchester United, he now looks like a bit of a superstar in Fulham's impressive season so far. But my vote goes to a left back who worked his way up the Football League pyramid and is now playing in the Premier League at mighty Nottingham Forest, Harry Toffolo. This time last year, he was at Huddersfield. He was part of their charge to the playoff final, bombing forward from left wing back. He got 8 assists in the process. He then got his move to the Premier League in the summer, which completed a 3-year turnaround from winning League Two with the mighty Lincoln City. There you go. I managed to get in a mention on the Christmas special. But yeah, 3 years ago, he was winning League Two with Lincoln. Now in the Premier League, He's been in and out of the Forest team with injury, but he was back in the side for the EFL Cup win against Blackburn. And so he is my alternative shout for Player of the Year, because I think he embodies so much of what we love about football sometimes, particularly me as a fan of the Football League, when we see players who've either played for our clubs or that we've seen at Football League level climb through the levels and make it to the Premier League. It's always really lovely to see. And he is an absolutely lovely, lovely lad as well. So I wish him all the best for 2023 too.
Yeah, Tom, I think you might have superseded me there with Harry Toffolo. You said it was a tough act to follow, but actually I love that shout and I get every reason why you've selected him. But I got to say, if I'm going to use my powers as the host on this podcast to give an official award out for the Game Podcast Alternative Player of the Year for the calendar year 2022, I'm going to go for Molly Hudson shout, Millie Bright. But listen, I want you guys to go online. You can do it right now. Time's up. You can go online at thetimes.co.uk as well. And you can actually vote, given all of our suggestions, for your Alternative Player of the Year. And we will tell you who has picked up that award from you, the fans, very, very soon. There is one more thing that I do want to discuss with you. And it's actually, I guess, you know, should we mention other companies? I don't know. Are you allowed to say the acronym BBC? Are we allowed to talk about the British Broadcasting Corporation? Do you just switch off? Are you one of the, have I lost you already just by mentioning them? Because that can happen. But listen, Sports Personality of the Year happened. Beth Mead became the first women's footballer to win. You know, we also had this week the Women's Champions League with two English clubs finishing top. And I think we're getting to the stage now where the importance of women's football and the stars and every single PR person that I've spoken to about how do you create a sport which grows, and it boils down to having superstars. It boils down to having personalities and people who fans gravitate towards, not just on the sport. We're now reaching a point now with women's football and the success of the Lionesses where we should see this with more regularity, as great as it is for Beth Mead. Women's football is getting that recognition. It's getting those eyeballs on it. And there will be more awards and more success on a personal note for the players to come, I imagine.
Yeah, I think it's quite fitting, I suppose, that we're discussing this at a sort of almost end of year kind of show vibe, because it's been such a, I think in sort of 10, 20 years time, you'll look back on this year being the one that transformed women's football forever. And that sounds like a grand statement, but I mean, last week or possibly the week before, I went to the film premiere of the Lionesses. Like, that wouldn't have happened. Obviously, winning the Euros. Just incredible kind of growth. And I think, look, there's still a long way to go, don't get me wrong. And I think part I would like to say to, to speak to our listeners directly. Like, reading the comments on the Times, I was speaking to one of my editors the other day, and the way it changes the Euros has been really, really pleasing to see people genuinely engaging now and appreciating these players, I suppose, for what they were, for what they are. And I think part of that is that maybe people used to read my articles or read stuff we did on the website, but had never really engaged with it. They'd never properly sat down and watched a women's match and probably thought, you know, what's this sort of overhyped stuff that's being fed down our throats or whatever. And now people are starting to watch it and see the talent of these players. And I think nobody epitomises that hard work and that sort of incredible year more than Beth Mead. And I was so happy to see her win that award, knowing what she's gone through on and off the pitch in the last sort of 12 months or so. I mean, obviously for this is probably speaking to people that already know this, but obviously she was left out of the Team GB squad in 2021, which was a massive blow for her. Her mum was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in that same year. Then this year they found out that cancer was in fact terminal. So she's been dealing with all of that while also having the absolute best sort of year of her career, won the Golden Boot in the Euros, won player of the tournament, obviously won the trophy, second in the Ballon d'Or. I mean, she's just had the most incredible year. And I think to see how at the end of that Euros, there was a moment in Trafalgar Square where she stood behind the trophy. And I think it's Alex Scott that's interviewing her and she's saying sort of, how's it going to change you? And she just said, I am Beth Mead, and that's never going to change. And that's just who I am. And I think that, in a sentence, is why people have learned to love the Lionesses and women's football in general, because they're not prima donnas. They've not grown up with loads of money being these hot prospects for their whole career. They've had jobs, you know, they've, like Lucy Bronze has worked in Domino's or whatever. Like, there's so many stories like that in women's football. And I think now people are really engaging with that and seeing that, which is, it's just a pleasure to be part of. And, you know, I'm genuinely buzzing for next year and seeing what they can do in the World Cup.
Yeah, I think Molly's right. And the points about some of the reader comments, I completely agree with. I think that's been really interesting. One of the bits that stands out when you think about that, and you think about these awards that they've won so justifiably, it was fascinating to hear Mead and Jill Scott and the others talk about us being here as women, as elite, as sports stars, you know, makes the conversation a more normal one for the British public. And that to me is the most significant thing. And that's where you get more positive comments, because winning an international tournament at a home stadium in the way that they did has made these players not just superstars, but household names. And I was just fascinated listening to Molly talk there and thinking about the fact that, as well as working very hard, all of my bosses, please don't think I'm not, I've also in the last few weeks been prepping the family Christmas quiz, which I always do every year. And the pitch around, obviously going to include one of the stars of that women's team. And I found it so hard, because I like to make it a challenge, I found it so hard to pick a player that wouldn't be instantly recognizable. And that is what says the most to me, that my dad, my mum, my brother, my sister, my uncles and aunties, it was so hard for me to find a player that wouldn't go, oh, that's Chloe Kelly, that's Jill Scott, that's Leah Williamson. That is what was so wonderful about that tournament success, and what is then equally wonderful about watching them win all the awards at the BBC Sports Personality, is that it shows that they have gone from being just footballers to being household names. And that is a massive, massive win for the women's game.
I was just going to say, I think we should now measure all social and cultural change by whether it makes it into Tom's family Christmas quiz. I think that's a very good litmus test. Every year we should hear the questions and understand, you know, what is now the standard for wider society.
I do think it is important, Tom, that you at least bring us a sample on our next podcast of some of the questions that you ask, maybe the sports related ones, and we'll see if we can answer them ourselves the next time that we are with you. But you guys have left me on that final note with a warm and fuzzy feeling ahead of this Christmas. I wish you all a very, very Merry Christmas. Thank you all for listening throughout 2022. Much, much more to come, of course, from the Game Podcast in the next year. Enjoy your Christmases. We'll be back with you between Christmas and the New Year's Day fixtures. I think we'll come to you after the next full round of fixtures. So we will encompass all of the team's first game back in the Premier League. But like I say, hit the notification button and you won't miss that episode. You'll get a notification as soon as it is released. Hit subscribe wherever you are as well to make sure that you don't miss an episode of the Game Podcast. You can go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame to do that as well. We will see you very soon. Merry Christmas. Take care.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.